This is the Stamfords podcast at the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival at Destinations in Olympia.
Welcome, Paul Blizzard with John Julius Norwich.
You having a nice festival?
You shameless exhibitionists.
Who's decided where they're going on holiday yet? Who's going on a cruise? Who's not going to America because the Form online visa application is so damn complicated? Now, there was lots of talk about this last night at the Edward Sanford Travel Writing Awards. Who would have gone to America but has changed their mind, actually? Oh, actually, a few of you. Right-minded people all. Right-minded people all. It's an enormous pleasure to be sharing, well, one, to be here at the Edward Sanford Travel Writers Festival once again, the third year of its running. How many of you have been here before and know how this works and what we do? Well, it's very nice to see you all back again. I do see some familiar faces. But it's a real honour to be with a man who I've shared a stage with in the past, John Julius Norwich, who, if you know anything about John Julius Norwich, you know one thing, that he is not only an inveterate traveller, but he's one of those rare breed of intelligent, observant travellers who has a deep understanding of the destinations to which he goes and then has the facility to write about it in ways that are fascinating, engaging. It's kind of the Reithian triptych of what the BBC should be for, and John Julius does it. He entertains, informs and educates. So please give him another round of applause. We're not really going to talk about a specific book, but all your books, or the recent ones, are for sale at the Stamfords writing thing after this. But what I really want to talk to you about is a sort of a look back at your lifetime in travel, what travel has given to you, what it's made, how it's formed you. And perhaps the best place to start is first memorable journey, first memorable trip, first memorable destination.
I can tell you about that exactly. It was about a week before my 7th birthday. And my mother took me to Aix-les-Bains. She was going to do The Cure. And I was going to talk French. I spoke actually pretty good French anyway, because I'd had a French lady who came 3 times a week to see me from the age of 4.
Good Lord.
So I can't actually remember when I couldn't speak fairly fluent French. I mean, I'm not bilingual, but I'm fluent and easy. And always was even then. And my mother took me to France, and I was absolutely fair. We went, of course, by the boat. We went Dover-Calais. It was pretty rough, but we had a thing. We didn't have a cabin. We had a sort of halfway thing called an alcove, which you could sort of draw the curtains over if you were really throwing up too badly, you know. But I didn't. And then a long train journey, and I was so fascinated. My mother said, "Do you realize there are no hedges in France? And there aren't like there are in England, you know. Have these enormous great fields. Sometimes they change colour, but they're not actually divided." And I was fascinated, I remember, by that. And then getting to Paris, and the excitement of seeing... I'm in France, I'm in Paris, the thrill of it. It was just getting dark. It was about 6, 7 in the evening. And the marvellous thing is that now, when you go to Paris, you take the Eurostar, and it's back like it was when I was a child. I mean, all those awful intervening years when you had to go off to airports and go in all through endless suburbia, it was an absolute nightmare. Now you get out of the Gare du Nord, just as I got out at the age of 7, and there are exactly the same buildings out there as there were then. The Grand Hotel du Nord, the Grand Brasserie du Nord, they're all there just as they were when I first remember them. It gives you a sort of marvellous whoosh of recollection, you know. And then I remember the first night of the Eiffel Tower, and then, there was nothing much more very exciting about that, but I remember the second time she took me, which was 6 months later. I was by this time 7, and she took me skiing. She'd never been skiing before, and I'd clearly never been skiing before. It was terribly brave of her, just her and me. And off we went, and we took the night train to Turin. We were going to a place called Sestriere. And I remember waking up in the morning, it's terribly exciting, with the deep snows. You know, there'd been nothing at night the night before in Paris at all. And then suddenly this marvellous snow. And a huge sign saying, "Mussolini ha sempre ragione." And I said to my mother, "What does that mean?" And she said, "It means Mussolini is always right." And I said, "Well, how can that be? Because you were just telling me the other day about the Pope and how he's infallible and he's always right." So what happens if the Pope and Mussolini disagree? Not a bad question for seven, was
Very
it, really?
Good.
But I always remember her answer. Well, it just shows you how ridiculous the whole thing is. That's what she said. And that was one of my first great lessons, I think, I learned travelling.
Did it feel exotic? Did it feel exotic to you?
Well, I always thought travel was exotic. I mean, I thought Dieppe was exotic. Yeah. I just loved the idea of being abroad. And then when war broke out, when I was 10, I was at a rather seedy little boarding school that my English day school, my London day school, had joined for the duration in Northamptonshire. And I had, all through the fall of France, thought that I had measles, and I was just recovering. And my mother came down and took me out to lunch in Buckingham and said, you're going to America. And I think she thought that I was going to burst into tears and say, oh, please, please, mummy, darling, I don't want to leave you. Instead of which I thought, America, New York, skyscrapers, cowboys, Indians, Hollywood, film stars, I couldn't wait. Couldn't wait to be off. So that was quite fun. And I was there in America and Canada. I went to school in Canada and spent my holidays in America. So six times a year I used to take the night sleeper between New York and Toronto.
At the age of 10, 11?
At the age of 10, 11,
In the early 1940s?
That's right.
That's proper adventure for a
10-year-old. That was proper
boy.
Adventure. And then even more proper adventure was coming back on a cruiser in 1942.
Good heavens.
Through U-boats were everywhere in the Atlantic, and we didn't have a convoy. We came back all by ourselves. And, that would have been frightening if I'd had any imagination. But fortunately, I didn't have any at all, so I wasn't frightened a bit.
What a brilliant gift your mother gave you, effectively the world, although enhanced.
Yeah. Well, she gave me more than anybody else in the world has given me, and more than any school I've ever been to.
Yeah, absolutely.
What do you think
it did to you in terms of inspiration? Because obviously it set you up for a lifetime of travel, a lifetime of adventure,
a lifetime of exploration. Well, I always longed to travel. I used to go to bed with an atlas and just look at the maps. And look at the names of the places and see, I was fascinated by all the Chinese names, Fuzhou and things like that, and Yokohama and all that. I was absolutely thrilled by the whole idea. And when I left Oxford in 1952, in those days, of course, people still weren't traveling much. Now everybody travels all over the world all the time. They don't stop for a minute because you can be in Singapore in 12 hours, and the world's become a very small place. But in 1952, it was still a pretty big place, so it took a long time to get anywhere. You went everywhere by train still. If you wanted to go to Greece, it took you about 5 days on the train and another 5 days back, So you had to have quite a long holiday before it was worth going there at all. And I longed to travel, and in those days I thought, the only two jobs I can get in which I can travel are, one of them is join the Foreign Service, and the other one is journalism.
Ah.
So I thought, I'll try for the Foreign Service, and if I get it, that's fine. And if I don't get it, I'll be, a foreign correspondent.
And what happened?
Well, I got into the Foreign Office by a whisker. And then I found myself, of course, firmly rooted in London for the next 4 years. But after that, I was sent off to Belgrade. They promised they were going to send me to Moscow because I'd read Russian at Oxford, and I was longing to get a bit of conversational practice because that was the one thing you couldn't do in those days of the Cold War,
Of course.
You couldn't just go and stay with a nice Russian family in St. Petersburg. I knew the language fairly thoroughly, but I was still almost unable to ask for the butter.
This is Belgrade. Was this Belgrade under Yugoslavia under Tito at that point?
That was under Tito.
And right.
The last moment, they changed their minds and didn't send me to Moscow after all, and sent me to Belgrade. So I learned Serbian very quickly because Serbian and Russian are terribly alike.
Yep.
It's like Spanish and Portuguese or something like that. And we had 3 years in Belgrade, which was perfectly fascinating. In those days, it was still very, very, very Balkan. Indeed, with herds of pigs being driven down the main street and all that.
Ox carts and woodcutters.
There was one traffic light in the whole city, and all the peasants, when they came up to Belgrade for the day, used to stand for hours watching it change colour.
Good
they
Lord.
Couldn't believe it. that's how primitive it was. And then we went straight from there to Beirut, which was, of course, just the opposite. That was immensely, well, first of all, the most glorious climate in the world, and delicious restaurants, and, you know, everybody was much richer than we were in Beirut. In Belgrade, we'd been much richer than anybody else.
But right.
In Beirut, we were brought down a peg or two.
While we're on Yugoslavia, can I tell you a brief anecdote? Because we're here at the Stanford's Travel Writers Festival. In the Stanford's archives, I was shown yesterday a really rather lovely document, which is an invoice dated, I think, 6th of September 1937, for a man who had requested a 16 miles to the inch map, road map, of Yugoslavia. And the name at the top of the invoice is the Right Honourable Winston Churchill, who was obviously planning a few trips to also Yugoslavia, as we knew. What was can we come back a little bit, John Julius? Your first conscious trip, either as a teenager or as now, when you were not at your mother's, you know, forced to go where your
yes,
mother
when
went
I, when
to,
I was
but when you had the right to and the funds to go somewhere of your own volition, of your own choosing. What was the choice?
Well, of course, when we're living in Belgrade, you may have completely different choices, because I never went back to London all the time I was in Belgrade.
Right.
It would have been a waste of time. I mean, I knew there were all wonderful other places to go to. So we, my first wife and I, we sailed a lot around the Greek islands in the holidays, taking little you know, boats between the islands and all that. That was most enormous fun. And we also took drove to what has since become, after Venice, my favourite city in the world, which is Istanbul. And we drove and drove and drove. We were slightly delayed by running over a cow in Bulgaria. We didn't get to Istanbul until about 2 o'clock in the morning, and we were absolutely dead. We'd been in that car for about 16 hours. It was a Land Rover. It was a fairly uncomfortable car anyway. And we got there and just fell into bed. And then I remember getting out of bed the next morning and drawing the curtains and seeing that great sweep of the Bosphorus and thinking, wow, you know, this really is something extraordinary. And I fell in love with Istanbul. I'd already knew, you know, I'd been fascinated by the idea of Byzantium for some time before. So I knew a fair amount about it.
Right.
But I'd never actually been there. And in those days, this is in 1956, it was still a fairly sad city. I mean, you know, you couldn't buy a safety pin. There were no nice restaurants to go to at dinner. There were some very nice lunch ones, but they were all shut in the evenings, I remember. And so that was quite boring in itself. But I don't know, I fell in love with it, and I've been back there God knows how many times since. And I've always loved it and been fascinated by it.
It is a hell of a city. In fact, the previous speaker is just about to write a piece on Turkey. He's half Turkish, and he's going to walk Turkey and have a look at the contemporary politics under Erdogan. You mentioned, of course, the city that you said is your favourite in the world, the city that you love, the city that you are, I think, a chairman of one of the boards boards that is involved with the maintenance and upkeep of Venice. Is that right?
Well, I was. I more or less started it, actually. I was the first chairman. When Venice had these terrible floods, I mean, now she's getting terrible floods all the time, but the first and still the worst were those of 1966.
Yes.
And they which were in a class by themselves. And the Italian government, well, Florence flooded at the same time, too. So, I mean, it was really a terrible moment. And the Italian government appealed to the United Nations. It said, you know, this is too big a crisis. If you knew what it's like being Italy and having to keep all these incredible numbers of wonderful masterpieces all looked after, insured. You know, it's a nightmare. It's too big for any one country. So UNESCO did a big survey of Venice and discovered that it was in a far worse state than anybody had expected or dared to think. And so they appealed to all their member countries all to do something, whatever they could. And we in England, it was actually Sir Ashley Clarke, who had been the ambassador in in Rome till very, very recently. And he rang me up and said, we're founding this organization to try and save Venice from falling into the sea. Will you be chairman? And I said, no, of course I won't be chairman, actually. You've got to be chairman. You're the ex-ambassador. You're bilingual in Italian. You know all the Italian ministers by the by their first names, and you can go and thump on the table in a way I can't. And he said, no, because my wife and I, we're going to live in Venice and oversee all the work that's going to be done. This is fundraising. This has got to be done from London. So I couldn't think of any more reasons to say no, so I said yes. And I was chairman of it for the next 41 years. And suddenly, when I was 82, I suddenly was going there one afternoon. I thought, my God, I've been doing this for exactly half my life. This is too long. And I resigned that afternoon.
How many of you have eaten in a Pizza Express restaurant? Anybody eaten in Pizza Express? Come on, no, you more have. If you look closely
our
at the
greatest
menu...
greatest benefactors.
Exactly. The Pizza Veneziana Express. Pizza... still to this day makes a contribution to the very fund that you
have. Veneziana.
Exactly. Why is Venice so special to you?
Well, I mean, there are so many reasons. I mean, when that lovely American humorist, who everybody's forgotten now, but he was a very funny man, called Robert Benchley. Mm. When Robert Benchley first went to Venice, he sent a telegram back to his publishers in New York, saying, streets full of water, please advise. And I suppose, you know, that's the first thing anybody thinks about when they think about Venice, that as Robert Browning rather more poetically put it, the sea's a street there. But what is fascinating to me always is why? I mean, why did anybody in their senses want to build a city, let alone the most beautiful city in the world, but I mean, why did they want to build anything in the middle of a malarial lagoon, you know. It doesn't make sense. And the only reason they did, if you come to think of it, the only reason why anybody would, they were scared out of their wits. Fear is one of the great incentives in human nature. And you see, there was no Venice in the days of the Roman Empire or anything like that. It was just a lagoon, maybe a few people gathering salt, but that was about all. And then suddenly in the 5th century, the barbarians, the Goths, followed by the Huns, followed by the Vandals, all come sweeping down from Central Europe, aiming for Rome, of course, where the best pickings are, but laying waste and ravaging and plundering everything on their path. So all the great riches, all the great rich cities of northern Italy have to flee for their lives. And where can they flee to where these barbarians, who've never seen the sea before, are not going to pursue them? Out into the Venetian lagoon. Barbarians have never seen a boat. I mean, there's nothing they can do to... They're perfectly safe. And the great thing to remember about the lagoon is it's extremely shallow. Mm. I mean, through half of it, you can wade about that deep. And, of course, shallow water is a much better defence than deep water. Any fool can sail across deep water. Shallow water, you've got to know the shoals, the sandbanks, the eddies, or you run aground. And so the Venetians, thanks to this... It was really a sort of glorified moat that in which they lived were completely safe. And they were the only city in the whole of Italy, really, just about, which was never once sacked or plundered or destroyed. Because they were safe, and they knew they were safe, and they didn't want to know about Italy. They look east to Constantinople and further, and hence the great trading empire. That's why how they managed to dominate the whole of the Eastern Mediterranean and had bases, I mean, as far as China. You know, it was entirely due to this incredible security.
Quite.
That they had, which was completely unique.
What do you can you give us a brief prognosis, your prognosis of the future for Venice in a world of global warming and rising waters? Are you
it's
optimistic?
Pretty,
or?
It's pretty desperate.
Right.
I'm afraid. I mean, well, the worst problem now, I'm afraid, is mass tourism.
Exactly.
These huge, great leviathans of ocean liners, about the size of things that used to go, or bigger than things that used to go across the Atlantic, you know, with 5,000 passengers on board. And sometimes three of them a day arrive in Venice in the summer. They dump 15,000 passengers. who spend no money in Venice at all because they've bought all their meals on board before they leave England. And all they do is completely clog up the city. There's no room to move. I mean, walk across St. Mark's Square in the middle of the day in the summer, it's like Selfridges with two shopping days before Christmas. You know, it's just a nightmare.
Do you have a solution for this?
Because more and more of them are coming. And I regret to say, it's entirely the Venetians' fault. Of course, they get paid such enormous landing fees that they can't resist them.
Quite.
So, meanwhile, the Carnival Cruises and all, whoever they are building bigger and bigger ships. They'll be holding 7,000 soon, you know, and they're all full. I mean, I can't think of anything more nightmarish than to be with 7,000 people cruising the Mediterranean, you know. But there it is. You see these irresistible-looking commercials on the telly with a beautiful boy and a beautiful girl clinking their martini glasses against the sunset. And it looks too lovely, but you know that if the camera was going to pull out, there'd be 15 million other people all the way around, you know. It's not as good as it looks.
I point this out with some hesitancy, but we are here at a travel show where people may be looking at cruise
operators. I'm aware of this, but I felt it my duty to make the point.
So how would you advise the responsible cruise passenger to travel?
Well, I would advise him, first of all, not to do the Mediterranean. The Mediterranean has been, I think, ruined by cruise ships. If you're going to do the Mediterranean, which is, I mean, the loveliest place in the world, do it the way it used to be done. Take trains and boats. It's much, much more fun.
Trains and boats, exactly.
It's and you get a tenth of the price.
And you get to talk to the people that live in the places that you're going to visit, which is always a bonus.
You know, and I mean, that's the way everybody used to do it. So it's not difficult. And I say it's infinitely cheaper. And I find it a great deal more fun. If you do a cruise, and I do see the joy of the cruise, the rest and having everything done for you and the lovely weather and all that, I would suggest doing a cruise, doing a river cruise. The river cruises are wonderful.
The Rhine, the Danube.
The Elbe,
yes.
That's marvellous. I've done the Elbe and the Rhine, and they're both wonderful. You're guaranteed calm weather. You don't have those awful sort of 3 or 4 days at sea with nothing to do at all. You know, there's something to do every single day. I think river cruises are the thing. Or, alternatively, last year, I did a cruise for Swan Hellenic, now, alas, gone. When it called itself a Hellenic cruise, it started in Sri Lanka and it ended in Muscat, so it wasn't terribly Hellenic. But it was a perfectly fascinating cruise. And there, of course, you don't have, up the west coast of India, or indeed in Muscat, you don't have any crowds at all.
Quite.
It's like it always was.
Exactly. I was going to ask you, but I think it's probably an inappropriate question now. Have you ever been invited by cruise operators to be one of the people that speaks on the cruise?
Yes, I've done it quite a lot.
Oh, so you have, right.
Yeah, I mean, that was what I was doing that time.
I'm guessing you won't be able to do it for the...
For Swan Hellenic, yeah.
Exactly. Before we come to questions, I want to talk about one more thing, because you've written a beautiful book about it, which is why Sicily holds a special place in your heart.
Yeah, well, that's another one of my favourite places.
Right.
I mean, I owe Sicily a most enormous debt, apart from anything else, because it was really the subject of my first proper book. I had written half a book with a friend before about Mount Athos in Greece. But the first proper book I did was Sicily. That was because I was working in the Foreign Office in those days. It was in 1961. And we had a Middle Eastern crisis. Iraq, surprise, surprise, invaded Kuwait. And there was all sorts of fuss. It wasn't Saddam Hussein. It was a man called Abdul Karim Qasim. Mm-hmm. And I was, anyway, working all day and most of the night, all through the summer. And I didn't get any leave until October, by which time the crisis was over. And I said then to my first wife, you know, if we want any sunshine and warmth, we've got to go quite a long way south. It's mid-October, you know. So we decided to go to Sicily. That was the only reason we decided to go. We might otherwise have gone anywhere else. But we went to Sicily. We drove down from England in a little Fiat car and took the boat. We drove down as far as Naples and then put it on the boat for the night. And it's a lovely trip because you go past Stromboli, the island volcano, which is always doing its stuff a little bit. I mean, you know, so that's great for family. You go past it in the early hours of the morning. And at about 8, you arrive in this wonderful, wonderful harbour, the Golden Shell, the Concordoro of Palermo. And then we drove off sightseeing. Is what I like doing. And I was absolutely flabbergasted by these monuments from the Norman period. And I don't think I'd ever known that the Normans were in Sicily then. No, there was no book about it that I knew of. I'd certainly not read one. And here is these incredible monuments where the three great civilizations of the Mediterranean, the Latin, Western European, whatever you like to call it, the Greek and the Arab, all came together. When the Normans invaded Sicily, just about the same time as they invaded us in the second half of the 11th century, Sicily was inhabited about two-thirds by Arabs and one-third by Greeks. They knew that if they were going to make a go of this, there weren't very many Normans, if they were going to make a go of it, they would have to get both the Greeks and the Arabs on their side. And this, incredibly, they did. And they had this wonderful kingdom where Greek, Arabic, and Norman, French, and Latin were all official languages of the country. The Greeks, who were always the best seamen, ran the navy. The Arabs, who were always the best mathematicians, ran the treasury and the finances. And it worked like a charm. Not for very long, it has to be said, but that was for other reasons, nothing to do with them. And it was perfectly wonderful. If you go to the Palatine Chapel in Palermo, which is one of the most extraordinary buildings in the world, I'm sure many of you know it, you go in there, the ground plan is like an ordinary English parish church might be. I mean, there's a central nave and two side aisles and a few steps up to the chancel. I mean, they're the ordinary sort of shape, the way you're used to. But the walls encrusted with Byzantine mosaics of the 12th century, as good as anything as you can find in Istanbul today. And a roof, which is pure Arab stalagmite roof, which would be a credit to any mosque in Cairo or Damascus.
Quite.
Or covering a Christian church. I mean, it's absolutely unbelievable. And there is there's a little village of Cefalù, it's a little town, really, about an hour and a half's drive from Palermo, which contains in it this huge, in the east end, in the apse, the high apse above you in the east end, an enormous mosaic figure of Christ the Pantocrator, the ruler of all, which for me is the greatest picture of Christ in all Christian art. It's the top. It's the best. In my view, I mean, it's worth going to Sicily just to look at that. I mean, I've seen people standing in front of it for half an hour with tears pouring down their cheeks.
Good heavens.
It's unbelievable.
Sicily.
Yeah.
There we go.
So that's why I love the place.
While we're on islands, just because our own dear Prime Minister, caught as she is between a rock-headed president and a hard Brexit,
yes,
is in Malta today.
Oh, so she is, yes.
Has Malta figured on your travels?
I once made a film for the BBC about the Knights of Malta.
Indeed.
It is wonderful, Malta. It's incredibly beautiful because it's all made of the same stuff. It's made of this wonderful, mellow, honey-coloured rock, which is what the whole of the island is made of. I mean, it's all there is. It's the only thing you can build with. And it happens to be perfectly beautiful. And it gives the island a wonderful unity because everything is built of the same stuff. It's rather like the old city of Jerusalem, which has the same effect. And a lot of very, very, very good top-of-the-second-league architecture. I wouldn't put any of it absolutely in the top league, but it's sort of beta plus-plus.
Okay.
Masses of that. So it makes it... It's very, very beautiful, as I think, as a complex. In 1976, when I was there, the principal trouble was the food. because, I mean, anywhere that has been inhabited by the Royal Navy for 400 years, the food is almost certain to be filthy. And in Malta, my God, it was. And the director, who was rather a sort of gourmet, and I got quite panicky after 3 or 4 days, trying to find somewhere where we could just get a decent meal. And I remember we drove in despair further and further out of Valletta every day looking for a good restaurant. And somebody had told us that there was a hotel way up the other end of the island. So we drove for an hour to get to this place and got to this sepulchral dining room where we were the only table occupied. 200 tables, just us. All the others were empty. And there was one waiter who was exactly like Manuel in Fawlty Towers. And he brought this enormous menu. And I said, I looked down it, and I saw something called Turkey Valletta. And I thought, well, what can that be? It's probably disgusting. But anyway, let's try. So I said to Manuel, what's the turkey like? And Manuel looked completely blank and said, I go find out, and disappeared into the kitchen. Came back 2 minutes later, beaming, saying, it's like very big chicken.
Did you ever eat rabbit on Malta?
Yeah, I can't remember what we ate. Every meal was a gastronomic crucifixion. That's all I can tell you. But I'm sure it's much better now. That was 40 years ago. That has changed now. I mean, one of the good things that tourism does, it makes sure you have good restaurants.
I don't think Theresa May will be eating Turkey Valletta today.
I think she won't.
Somehow.
Well, for her sake,
One sort of cheap and cheerful question for me before we open to the floor is it, given how much you have travelled, given how much of the world you have seen, is there still a destination that you have a burning desire to go to that you've not yet walked over? Oh, really?
I've never really been to the South Sea Islands.
Right.
Everybody tells me Tahiti is horrible. But Bora Bora and the Gilbert and Ellis, I mean, some of those other ones. I would love to go to those.
Yeah.
I've been to the Galapagos, but apart from their extraordinary wildlife, I mean, Galapagos is exactly like Surrey. There are no lovely swaying palm trees or any of the things that you like to think about, you know. That's one place. I'd like to see the Victoria Falls.
Right.
Which I've never done. As I grow so enormously old, I find that I think I've seen most of the great artificial wonders of the world, the great buildings,
right.
And those things. I think not all of them, obviously, but I've seen most of them, most of the ones I particularly want to see. And as I get old, I'm getting more and more keen on natural beauties.
Mm.
I long to go to New Zealand. Everybody tells me. Yeah. South Island of New Zealand is the most beautiful place in the world. I've never been. I'm 87. I shan't go there now. Anyway, my wife says it's too bloody far. So,
too bloody far. That's sort of what this expedition's all about, this vessel's all about.
What no traveller should ever say.
No, well, exactly. Although, through great writing, everything's actually quite close. You can sit in your armchair, even in Surrey.
I know, even in Surrey.
And transport yourself to New Zealand through the pages of a good travel book. Now, we have a young fellow in a waistcoat called Roddy, who's got a microphone. It's your chance to pitch your own questions to John Julius while we have him here, before he jets off somewhere else. Who'd like to kick us off with the first question? None of you have a question for
John. Is there anywhere you've been that you would think to yourself, oh, good God, I'm never going back there again?
We're over here.
Is there
anywhere that you've been, I'll never go back there again?
Is there anywhere you've been to that you would hate to go back to?
Quite a few.
Name them.
Dare I? Yes.
Broadly.
Well, I certainly wouldn't go back to Diyarbakir, which is a great big town in eastern Turkey.
Right.
Which is the only town where I've ever actually been stoned.
So you've been stoned?
I was stoned, yes.
Not in the drug smoking
sense? No, not a loss in that sense.
Oh, right, okay.
No, that wouldn't have been so bad. No, no, I mean, people hurling rocks at you.
Oh, good heavens, that's, you know, proper stoning, yes.
I certainly wouldn't want to go there again.
Are you at liberty
and
to
I'm
tell us why?
I'm told they still tend to do it, rather. It's still a bit of a problem city in Turkey. Not, I mean, God knows, but what's happening to Turkey now, I don't know. I mean, under Mr. Erdogan, anything could happen. It's a country I love so much, and seeing what's happening to it now under that nightmare man who's rapidly acquiring, as far as I can see, absolute power, it's very, very worrying indeed, you know.
I'm sorry to drive you back to this, John. Can you tell us why you were stoned? Was there a reason? Had you incurred the wroth of them in some way?
Why were we stoned? Not for any reason at all.
Oh, good heavens.
We were minding our own business. We were walking down the street. I think we might have been taking a few photographs of interesting buildings. And suddenly this barrage of stones.
A good reason not to go back.
Well, I thought so.
Exactly. Another question. Who do we have? Are you all alive? Are you quite happy? Are you... Yes? Okay, jolly good.
Thank you.
Very quiet, demure audience. Please, sir.
Yes. I share your love of Venice, and I'm going back again for another visit later this year. Is there anywhere you could recommend in Venice that I should go that I won't have been to before? Any some little gem that's off the beaten track?
Well, I mean, if I can certainly answer that question. You may reply, oh my goodness, I mean, I've known it for years, you know, I go there every time. But where I do go every time when I go to Venice is I go to the little Scuola di San Giorgio degli Schiavoni, which has these 9 paintings by Carpaccio, which it's the smallest and the loveliest art gallery in the world, because Carpaccio lived in the very, very beginning of the 16th century, about 1510, let's say, these were done. They're still hanging where they did when they were first put up, for the last 500 years. They've not been moved. And they're lovely pictures, because Carpaccio was, I think, one of the very few really great painters who had a sense of humour. And they are extremely funny. I mean, there is this lovely picture of St. Jerome with his tame lion. You know, Jerome always had a tame lion. Arriving at this desert monastery. And all the monks are in a state of absolute petrified terror. And they're charging sort of horizontally in all directions, going up the stairs to try and get away from this lion. And here's Jerome pointing at him. Look, you don't need to worry. I mean, he's 120 years old. He hasn't got a tooth in his head. He's blind as a bat. He wouldn't hurt anybody, and he probably can't even see you. And the monks aren't getting any of it at all. They're on their way off. Right. I mean, it's sort of little jokes like that. It's perfectly wonderful. It's not very far from St. Mark's. The Scuola di San Giorgio degli Schiavoni, which means of the Slavs. It was originally the Slav sailors who lived in it. And... the other thing I always do is I go to the little church of San Zaccaria, which is immediately behind St. Mark's, only 3 minutes' walk from St. Mark's. And I make sure I have a euro with me, a euro coin. And I walk into the church and I go about 20 yards up the left-hand side. And there is a picture of the Holy Family by Giovanni Bellini, which is, in my view, the most beautiful picture in the whole of Venice, and probably one of the most beautiful paintings in Europe. And you can put a euro in the slot, and it lights up. And I always, always, always do that, and always go there. And every time I look at it, it's better than I remembered. So there are two things, anyway.
Two good recommendations, I think. Here's a... something, as an inveterate traveller, is there a thing that you have to take? I asked this of Simon Reeve yesterday, the TV presenter. He said, a mosquito net. Everywhere I go, a mosquito net. Do you have a thing that you must take?
I've never carried a mosquito net in my life. I've carried mosquito repellent, but I've never had a net. No, I mean, in the old day, 40 years ago, I'd have said a camera.
Right.
Now I never take photographs.
Why not?
I've lost interest in it. I found I never looked at the ones I took.
Right.
And I now just look at the building. I mean, I remember I've always had a slight thing about photography. When I used to take groups, I used to be chairman of a little thing called Serenissima Travel, and we took small groups of people to exciting places around the world. And whenever we were sort of arrived in front of the Taj Mahal or wherever it was, you know, I always said, now, no photographs for 10 minutes. Quite. Just look at it. Don't always have to look at it through a tiny little viewfinder. Look at the building itself and really look at it and ask yourselves questions about it. What's it made of? Any particular reason why it should be made of that? Is it local material or did it have to be brought from a long way away? How are the proportions? Does it look just about right or does it look too tall for its breadth or too broad for its height? How would you improve it if you were doing it yourself? What are the windows like? Would it be nice to live inside? What's it for? Very important. I mean, is it a church? Is it for worshipping? Is it a town hall? Is it a royal palace? What would it be? Does it serve its purpose well? Would it work
quite
as a royal palace? And then the last question is always, name one interesting feature about this building that you wouldn't have noticed if you hadn't been doing this. And then take photographs. And you'll take much better photographs. You know, obviously, I mean, you'll know the building much better. Oh, no, and if you can, you can't always, but if you can, walk around.
Yeah. Final question for me, then. You may just have answered it, actually, but I suppose you can answer it in a different way if you wish. What would you discern as the difference between a tourist and a traveller?
I'm a tourist. I'm a traveller. You are tourists. They are trippers. That's the one.
Right.
You know, no, I think, really... I think...
I like the D.
A traveller... is someone who does all the work himself,
right,
and wants to, and doesn't just get on a boat and find himself in Venice because it's Tuesday. You know, a traveller buys his own tickets, decides where he wants to get off, decides where he wants to stay, and plans it all himself. I think that's really the principal difference.
I think it's a good distinction. But I also like the way you declined the verb tourist or traveller. Do we have any last questions? Opportunity for one last question if anybody would like to. Otherwise, we shall wrap up and I shall allow you to go and buy John Julius's books and go and join him at the signing tent over there. Nope, we're done. Then thank you to all of you for coming. Enjoy the rest of the exhibition. For those of you that might be interested, in 15 minutes, I'm back here with the fantastic traveller and really rather evolved TV presenter, who's a pretty damn good writer as well, Simon Reeve, whom some of you may have heard of. And in the meantime, John Julius will be signing, and I could recommend to you two books. If you're looking for something if you don't know his writing, do buy his book on Sicily. It's magnificent. And if you want something a little more historically about a city that he absolutely adores, John Julius Norwich's book on Byzantium. Both of them are over there. Thank you for being here, but thank you most to this man, John Julius Norwich.